A strange thing happened at an elite economics conference in 2005. While central bankers and policymakers celebrated the Great Moderation, an era of stable growth and low inflation, one economist stood up and warned that the financial system was becoming dangerously unstable. The room erupted in criticism. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, dismissed the concerns as Luddite. Yet 3 years later, the global economy would nearly collapse, validating what seemed like paranoia. What did this lone voice see that everyone else missed? Not greedy bankers or incompetent regulators, but something far more fundamental: deep structural cracks in the global economy that had been widening for decades, waiting for the right pressure to trigger catastrophe. Between 1975 and 2005, America fractured along educational lines. Top earners saw wages grow 65% more than bottom earners, widening the gap from 3-to-1 to 5-to-1. The college premium hit 72% by 2008. Bachelor's degree holders earned nearly double what high school graduates did. The counterintuitive truth? Jobs didn't suddenly require dramatically more skills. America simply stopped producing educated workers. From 1930 to 1980, average schooling increased a full year per decade. Then progress stalled, just 0.8 years total between 1980 and 2005. College completion rates from men born in the 1970s matched those born in the 1940s. The problem wasn't universities. America's higher education remains world class. The fault lines ran deeper. Poor quality elementary schools, underprepared high school graduates, and skyrocketing costs. Politicians saw the problem, but faced uncomfortable reality. Meaningful solutions would take decades. Direct redistribution faced fierce resistance. So they reached for something easier: credit, particularly for housing. Starting in the 1990s, both parties pushed aggressively for home ownership. By 2004, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were required to direct 56% of assets to low-income lending. By June 2008, these agencies held $2.7 trillion in subprime and Alt-A loans, 59% of all such loans. This orchestrated lending pushed house prices beyond sustainable levels. Default rates in subprime areas eventually reached 3 times those in prime areas. Credit had become a populist palliative for inequality, a band-aid over a wound needing surgery. Countries like Germany, Japan, and China built prosperity on export-led growth, deliberately creating powerful export sectors while suppressing domestic consumption. This imbalance would eventually destabilize the global economy. Post-World War II late developers needed to catch up quickly. Their solution? Climb the same ladder rich countries had used, moving from simple manufacturing toward innovation, while leveraging low labor costs through state enterprises and managed capitalism. Taiwan in the 1950s exemplified this approach, restricting industry entry, supporting incumbents with raw materials and capital, buying their production, imposing tariffs, and encouraging mergers. Households suffered through low wages, heavy taxation, poor interest rates, and cartel-inflated prices, all benefiting producers and financiers. Export orientation forced companies to create cost-competitive products while achieving economies of scale. But as these economies grew wealthy, problems emerged. Export industries remained disciplined by international competition, while protected domestic sectors grew inefficient. These economies became oddly misshapen. Super-efficient manufacturing alongside underdeveloped services, excessive focus on foreign demand while domestic consumption remained dormant. Taiwan's attempt to rebalance after the 1985 Plaza Accord proved disastrous. The Bank of Japan slashed interest rates, hoping to boost domestic markets, but instead triggered massive asset bubbles. When rates rose in the early 1990s, collapsing asset prices led to decades-long malaise. Export-led economies discovered they couldn't easily rebalance. Domestic consumption channels had atrophied, banks lacked capacity for independent credit decisions, and government spending flowed to influential but inefficient producers. The 1990s crises in Mexico and East Asia exposed a dangerous incompatibility between industrial countries' arm's-length systems based on transparency and legal enforcement and developing countries' relationship-based systems built on insider information and personal connections. When arm's-length investors financed relationship-based systems, they minimized risk through short-term loans, foreign currency denomination, and implicit government guarantees. This created poor investment screening and devastating crises. East Asian investment surged from 29% of GDP in 1988 to 42% by 1996, but foreign investors lacking local knowledge lent carelessly through domestic banks. Without traditional scrutiny, the system collapsed. After these crises, developing countries slashed investment from 41% of GDP in 1996 to 24% in 1998, transforming from net borrowers to net lenders. Their solution, cutting investment to avoid boom-bust cycles, increased vulnerability elsewhere by shifting demand creation to other countries. The massive foreign exchange reserves they accumulated went seeking safe homes, with the United States becoming the obvious destination. This would prove fateful. American unemployment benefits replaced just 50% of lost wages for 6 months, versus France and Germany's 57-63% for years. Job lost also meant losing affordable health insurance or facing denial for pre-existing conditions. The 1990-91 and 2001 recessions introduced jobless recoveries. Output rebounded quickly, but employment took 23 and 38 months to recover. America's weak safety net made recessions politically severe, creating immense pressure for stimulus. After the 2000-2001 NASDAQ crash, the Fed slashed rates from 6.5% to 1% by June 2003. Despite strong output growth, job creation lagged. The Fed maintained low rates, citing deflation fears, though misplaced since America faced a stock meltdown, not Japan's debt crisis. Rate hikes began in 2004, with signals they'd be slow and predictable, keeping long-term rates low, ultimately fueling the housing bubble. Low rates pushed institutions toward greater risk to meet liabilities. Rising asset values made households feel wealthier and take more risks. Money flowed into developing countries, whose central banks recycled dollars back into U.S. bonds, a circular flow that seemed sustainable until it wasn't. After 2000, Greenspan argued the Fed couldn't prevent bubbles but could mitigate the fallout, the Greenspan put. This told Wall Street the Fed wouldn't limit gains but would limit losses, encouraging collective risk-taking and discouraging precautionary reserves. Financial firms held risky mortgage-backed securities funded by short-term debt. These tail risks, rare events requiring system-wide adverse conditions, prove catastrophically costly when realized. Yet their rarity ensures firms ignore them, paradoxically increasing their likelihood. When bankers blame troubles on 1 in 10,000-year floods, they neglect that their actions made such events occur roughly once per decade. For managers lacking extraordinary investment skills, tail risk becomes seductive. Like writing earthquake insurance without reserves, this strategy generates impressive short-term returns with no apparent risk. When disaster strikes, managers have already collected substantial bonuses and can blame failure on rare catastrophe. Well-managed firms take calculated risks that won't destroy them. Yet AIG, Bear Stearns, Citigroup, and Lehman took virtually unbounded risks. Compensation systems rewarding profits without penalizing losses drove this behavior. UBS exemplified this when its investment banking unit borrowed at the bank's low AA-rated cost to invest in high-rated securities, generating substantial profits and bonuses, until the subprime crisis devastated the bank. Why weren't debt holders concerned? They believed government would intervene, an expectation justified by direct government intervention in housing markets and the too systemic to fail doctrine. When many large banks took identical risks, they would all weaken simultaneously, making government reluctant to let any fail. Despite technological progress, significant challenges persist. poverty in developing nations, aging populations with mounting debt in industrial countries, and climate change threatening disaster. The fault lines from 2008 haven't disappeared. They've shifted. Financial reform must reduce incentive distortions by managing expectations of government intervention. Markets favor protected institutions, distorting competition and encouraging reckless risk-taking. Traders' bonuses should be held in escrow, subject to clawbacks if positions lose money later. Systemically important firms should maintain additional capital buffers and living wills, detailed plans enabling quick resolution if failure looms. America must improve access to quality human capital. Success foundations are laid early through proper nutrition, education, and developing abilities like perseverance and self-discipline. Great teachers make enormous differences, but attracting talent requires better pay tied to performance and clearer career paths. The college enrollment gap remains stark. 79% of top-income youth attend college versus 34% from bottom-income households, with graduation rates of 53% versus 11%. For global stability, surplus countries must increase domestic spending while deficit countries save more. China would benefit from a stronger renminbi, allowing cheaper imports, higher interest rates, increasing household income, and broader pensions, encouraging spending over excessive saving. These problems can be solved through human ingenuity while addressing structural fault lines. The choice isn't between growth and fairness, it's between confronting hard truths now or waiting for the next earthquake.